Hello, my name is John McCann from Rutgers University in New Brunswick, New Jersey. I am the corresponding author on a paper titled Fear Learning Enhances Neural Responses to Threat Predictive Sensory Stimuli, to be published in the December 13th edition of Science. In this short podcast, I'm going to explain the basic findings of the study and try to put it in a larger context for non-experts. Most people, including most scientists, make the assumption that our sensory organs simply detect the world outside the body and feed this information to the brain. In this model, the eye is like a camera, the ear like a microphone, the nose like a chemistry lab, etc., and the job of the brain is to analyze this information to understand what stimulus is out there, to say, I see an elephant, or I hear the school bell, or I smell a gas leak. Naturally, we have assumed that only after these stimuli had been at least begun to be identified could the brain begin to interpret their significance and say, that bell means I'm going to be in trouble with my teacher, or that gas smell means I'm in danger. However, we hadn't been able to actually test this assumption because we had no way to monitor the activity of the earliest parts of any sensory system in any detail in a living animal. In this study, we watched the activity of the very first neurons of the mouse olfactory system, the sense of smell, and found to our surprise that the activity of those cells not only indicated what odors are present in the nose, but also increased their response when the mouse learned that a particular odor predicted they would receive a mild but unpleasant electric shock. This is surprising for two reasons. First, because it shows that the sensory system was incorporating information about the emotional value of specific odors at the input to the brain before the brain had a chance to interpret it. Second, the result is surprising because we tend to think of learning as something that happens deep in the brain after conscious awareness, but these new data show that even the earliest neurons in the sensory system can be changed as a result of learning. So those are the results in a nutshell. But now I'm going to step back and explain in more detail what we actually did in the experiment and where it fits in the big picture of our understanding of the brain. One of the big breakthroughs in neuroscience over the past decade has been the ability to genetically engineer mammalian brains such that we can use light to either observe what specific types of neurons are doing, using indicator proteins like synaptophorin, GCAMP, and ArcLight, or to control what those neurons are doing using effector proteins like channel rhodopsin. In fact, the mice used in this study are direct descendants of the first mice to ever use a genetically encoded optical indicator of neural activity, which I first reported 10 years ago in collaboration with my colleague Tom Baza, the molecular biologist who did the genetic engineering to develop these mice in the first place. In these mice, the neurons in the nose that physically contact the odor molecule express a genetic construct called synaptophorin that causes their synaptic terminals to fluoresce when they release neurotransmitter. These cells project their axons from the nose to the brain's olfactory bulb, where they make synapses onto various kinds of cells in the brain. So when we observe their terminals fluorescing, we are watching the first neurons in the olfactory system sending their signals out from the nose to the rest of the nervous system. This is sort of the olfactory equivalent of watching the output of the photoreceptors in the retina or the hair cells of the inner ear in a living animal, but olfaction is the only sensory system where it's technically possible to do this. In practice, we make these observations through an optical window that is surgically implanted in the mouse's skull at the beginning of the experiment. In addition to the kind of mouse we used, a critical part of this experiment was that we used what's called a longitudinal experimental design, where we observed the activity patterns evoked by a panel of different odors in the brain of each mouse, both before and after we taught the mouse to be afraid of just one of the odors. This allowed us to test for before and after changes within each individual animal, and to see if the changes were unique to the odor that predicted a shock, or if the response to other odors changed too. During the training process, where we teach the mouse to be afraid of an odor, which is called fear conditioning, the mouse is put into a plastic chamber with a metal floor, and two different odors are pumped into the chamber 5 times each in a random order. When one of the odors comes through, called the CS plus odor in the paper, the mouse receives an unpleasant electric shock through the floor, while when the other odor comes through, called the CS minus in the paper, the animal is not shocked. After this happens a few times, the mice become visibly scared when they smell the CS plus odor. They freeze in place, defecate, and so forth, but they are not scared of the CS minus odor. The CS minus thus provides a control odor that the mouse smells just as many times, but isn't scary. The odors we used were pure chemicals that are components of many common smells, and we varied which odors were the CS plus and CS minus from mouse to mouse. We also had some control groups, of course, including mice that underwent similar training to the fear conditioning procedure, but with the odors turned off or with the shocks turned off. So now let's talk about the results. First off, in the control mice that only received shocks or only received odors, nothing changed from the before imaging session to the after session, so we know that the mere delivery of odors and shocks has no effect on this part of the olfactory system. However, in the mice that did receive fear conditioning, we found that the response of the olfactory sensory neurons to the odor that did predict a shock was coming was greatly increased after fear conditioning compared to the before conditioning baseline, while the response to the other odors was not larger, if anything, they were a little smaller. As a point of reference, we found that the increase in response caused by fear conditioning was comparable to the increase caused by a fourfold increase in odor concentration. Now, it's worth noting that while the responses were bigger, they were in the same spatial pattern after fear conditioning as they were before, since the spatial pattern of the activity determines the perceptual quality of the odor, such as banana or strawberry. This means that the odor predicting the shock probably smelled like the same odor it always had, but it probably smelled considerably stronger. The finding that the very first neurons in the olfactory system are changed by fear learning is potentially significant in several ways. First, it means that the nervous system can become especially sensitive to threatening or emotionally charged stimuli right from the earliest parts of the sensory systems. This enhancement in neural response could serve as a neural warning signal to draw attention or enhance learning about the stimulus. Second, because the potential threat of a stimulus is included in the sensory representation of that stimulus, we speculate that malfunctions of this sensory processing could play a role in anxiety disorders like post-traumatic stress disorder that include sensory symptoms like hypervigilance and attentional bias towards trauma-associated stimuli. This work was funded in part by the National Institute on Mental Health on the basis of this rationale. Finally, traditional models of learning view learning as a process that follows after sensory processing of related stimuli. By showing associative, stimulus-specific neural changes in the output of the very first sensory neurons in the system, these data suggest that models of learning may need to incorporate changes in sensory inputs as part of the process. I would like to thank my co-authors, Marley Cass, Michelle Rosenthal, and Joseph Patakal, for their stellar contributions to this project, as well as NIMH and NIDCD for funding the work. All of these experiments were conducted in accordance with animal care and welfare protocols approved by the Rutgers University Animal Care and Use Committee. I can be reached for further comment at jmcgann@rci.rutgers.edu. That's jmcgann@rci.rutgers.edu. Thank you.